That was Funkadelics with Wake Up. Welcome to Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate. We're going to start the show with a little housekeeping. This is the last time the show will appear as Beneath the Surface. Instead, starting next week, we will be known as Red Future Radio. And to mark that occasion, we'll have a very special broadcast next week. But today, we're talking to Kendrick Frazier in the beginning of the show. Kendrick is the editor, the longtime editor of Skeptical Inquirer. He's also the editor of an anthology that appeared in the late summer. And that anthology is called Science Under Siege. It's a defense of critical thinking. This is extremely important because if you're ever going to change the world in any meaningful way, you've got to be able to know the world as it is and as it changes. And that's what critical thinking is all about. So we'll be talking to Kendrick Frazier, and this is a conversation I had recorded with him a number of weeks back. And as I was listening to this and thinking I wanted to bring this out, I thought of a really appropriate interview for the second half of the show, and that's with my favorite author, one of my favorite authors ever, Ursula K. Le Guin, the science fiction fantasy writer. And it was an interview I did with her about a couple years ago when she had a book come out called Voices, and it really speaks to the importance of critical thinking and the dangers of a society that loses that. So without any further ado, let's jump into it with Kendrick Frazier, the editor of Science Under Siege. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael. I'm very glad to be here.
Tell people a little bit about Science Under Siege.
Well, it's an anthology of articles dealing with very topical issues in the defense of science and in the exposure of what I might call anti-science or nonsense or pseudoscience. And these have been published over the last 5 years in our magazine, The Skeptical Inquirer, by a number of famous scholars and investigators and scientists. And I selected from those some of the very best and most topical and lively ones that I think articulate what you were just expressing, the battle over critical thinking and various manifestations of that in society at large today.
One of the things that I actually thought was really intriguing in what you said, in what you say in the book, is, and it's referred to a number of times by other people too, is that 400 years ago you had an assault on critical thinking, on science. There was this whole thing that developed, the Enlightenment came around, and all of these things happened. And then you come up to the recent times, and you've actually described this in some ways as being far more serious, one of the most serious assaults on science in modern times. Can you tell why you think that?
I think in America today, there's always been a very stream of anti-intellectualism, but in the last 15 years, the forces of anti-intellectualism assembled great political power, and they had houses to defend that in the churches and in the political activities on the conservative side of things. Why it happened exactly at this time in our history, it's baffling to a degree, isn't it? Because you would think with all of the modern science and technology of today, popular thinking would have gone along with that rather than in opposition to it.
I was just looking for the quote that you have here, which you say, even comparing to just in the last 40 or 50 years, you say 30 years ago, if people like Paul Kurtz and others were worried that we were in danger of descending toward a new dark age of superstition, paranormalism, mysticism, and pseudoscience, we in fact seem now to be in danger of descending towards a new dark age of a slightly different and perhaps even more dangerous sort. The first one was more of a credulous, wide-eyed acceptance of wondrous, incredible claims. In retrospect, it all has a certain air of innocence. These claims had their counterparts, after all, in science and could be seen or interpreted as just misguided but understandable fascinations uninformed by real science. But the new ones, the new areas that you're most concerned about, aren't like that at all. And you talk about them springing from deep-seated ideologies. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Well, it's a lack of tolerance. It's the lack of open-minded tolerance for others different from oneself. It's we need a love of learning. It's the opposition to a love of learning. It's a willingness to entertain new ideas. Instead, we have an opposition to new ideas, freedom of expression, freedom of the separation of church and state. All these things have been under strong attack for the last 20 years in American society and many more. The basic rights of women to make their own choices, to be educated, and to shape their futures. These are broad issues that in our magazine and our book we address in the context of anti-science attitudes. We try not to get totally into politics and into cultural disputes, but where evidence-based science is abused and neglected and distorted and denigrated, then it becomes a matter for people like us and our authors to expose that, to investigate it, and to give it a public airing.
Now, one of the things, as you're saying, is part of your description of there being this credulous wonder at whatever 30 years ago, and now these new areas. In my mind, there's certainly an element of the people actually buying into all this nonsense. But there's also a question, it seems to me, of there's a lot of conscious promotion of this from the highest levels. I mean, we just went through the era of the Bush regime, which I certainly don't think in terms of what they let loose in society that it's changed all that much. But this whole idea of a profound sort of official promotion of ignorance. To the extent where you have this country is one of the most scientifically illiterate countries in the world.
Yes, and I don't think many people will realize that. For instance, in acceptance of evolution, we rank 34th in the world, right ahead of Turkey. It's the only nation of 35 that is below us on acceptance of evolution. Now, evolution is, whatever one might think of it, one of the unifying principle of biology, and it's very important for students to understand it and understand the scientific evidence for it and see how robust that is and how deeply explanatory it is. But there are countless other examples. The same forces that try to deny evolution are also trying to keep textbooks from discussing the great age of the Earth and of the universe and all sorts of other very basic facts and principles of science.
Your book and your magazine has always been, you know, I remember the famous exposure of Uri Geller, which at the time I thought that was really good. It was really brilliant and what was going on and very important in a sense, although it really brought the Uri Geller stuff, put it in perspective of entertainment and not belief-based science or something, or science-based belief. But the thing is that nor is it that you guys are just a bunch of cranks who want to go out and destroy everybody's happiness. You actually have an approach to this, which I thought was kind of intriguing, because and it flows through your whole book, which is that science, and I think Androyan, is that how you pronounce her name?
Yes, uh-huh.
She made this point where she said, science is a never-ending search for truth. And it appears to me that you guys operate from exactly that perspective, is science is a never-ending pursuit of truth. So if you're going to say it, you got to play it all the way through. And you guys actually are insisting that people meet, as you say, a certain higher standard.
That's right. We try to deal with issues at the level that is appropriate. And many of these are very philosophical, intellectual issues that require fairly deep understanding and appreciation. But science, I just love science, and I think we'd all be better off if we appreciated both its power and its limitations. It's not everything, and it can't be everything, and it is also fallible. All scientific findings are open to revision based on new evidence, and that's what is the key thing that is so different in the anti-science efforts, where decisions are based on dogmatic and come down from authority. Science doesn't recognize authority. It only recognizes evidence and good argument based on scientific evidence, which is a very profound way of arriving at something close to the truth about the natural world.
Now, that's a point, too, because I think in an essay later in the book, and I can't remember, it might have been on the philosophy behind behind pseudoscience, a point was made around that science, I think maybe it was there, maybe somewhere else, but the point basically was that science, when it solves a problem, it opens up new problems. It reveals new problems, that there's a never-ending process of discovery, solving, and rediscovery of problems. And earlier in the book, and again running throughout the book, there's this whole theme from many of your authors about basically that you have to be prepared, as you're talking about methodologically, you have to be prepared, even if you discover something that suddenly totally turns upside down or disproves what has been accepted as a long-standing scientific theory, then you basically have to be willing to jettison that.
Yes, indeed. And it's happened throughout the history of science, and can always happen. So that's a very important part of recognizing what's unique about science. If the evidence is strong enough, you can overturn long-established ideas and principles. There's a lot of misunderstanding about that because so many scientific ideas are very well established, but there are others that could be turned over, but it requires very strong evidence. As the saying goes, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. So it doesn't just require someone coming up with an idea and making a claim. It would have to change a key scientific principle requires numerous experiments and numerous lines of evidence over periods of years and sometimes many decades. But it can and does happen, and scientists have to realize that. Actually, most scientists would just love to discover something new that overturns accepted scientific ideas. It happens all the time in science. Science is a great discovery engine. So most scientists who are doing research just love to find out new things. At the same time, there are long, generally well-established principles that support most of what is discovered, and most discoveries then have to generally end up reaffirming those principles, but finding new aspects to them.
Let me remind listeners, I'm Michael Slate, and today we're talking with Kendrick Fraser, the editor of Science Under Siege, Defending Science, Exposing Pseudoscience from Prometheus Books, and a longtime editor of the Skeptical Inquirer. Ken, I learned a lot in reading this book. I learned a lot, and I really enjoyed it, including the fact that I learned how to haunt a house, okay? Very good. There's so much in here in terms of both the pseudoscience that has become so popular today, the religious hoopla or magic show that is reasserting itself again in a way that probably hasn't happened since the Middle Ages. You know, but what are some of your favorite things? Out of all the things you chose to put in this book, what are some of a couple of the favorite chapters you have or favorite stories you have in there?
Well, I think the one you mentioned by Ann Drurian, Science, Religion, Wonder, and All, is one of my very favorites, and also her follow-up to a question-and-answer session that we ran by Carl Sagan on Science and Skeptical Inquiry, where she commented on what she called the great turning away from science and reason. So that's fairly provocative and important. There are numerous others, however, that are just more interesting. There's the little discussion of the Apollo landing myth, mm-hmm. which we heard quite a bit of at the 40th anniversary of the Apollo 11 missions, mm-hmm. and magnet therapy, a total investigation of the billion-dollar boondoggle about magnets. One of the most important ones we ran had to do with a what turned out to be essentially a fraudulent study about prayer having an effect on female fertility. And it was published in a peer-reviewed medical journal, and it caused so much concern among skeptical scientists that one of our authors investigated a physician and found out that so many flaws with that study that there's not even an expectation now that it was actually ever even carried out. One of the authors is now in prison for fraud on other matters. The other lead author at Columbia University disconnected himself from the study, even though he was presented as the lead author. So this is how pernicious sometimes things can be when an actual study that does not stand up to any sort of skeptical scrutiny actually is published in the scientific literature. And it's still there. The journal itself hasn't retracted it, even though it is, I'm sure, deeply embarrassed by it.
You know, along the same lines, one of the articles that I really, two of them that I really appreciated was The Memory Wars, about the hoax of recovered memories.
Yes.
And also The Predator Panic. I thought the two of them went really well together.
Well, The Memory Wars is by Martin Gardner, who's a national treasure and a longtime columnist for us. And you're right, He kind of put in perspective the memory wars of what was in the 1980s and early 90s when there were so many claims of recovered memories and so many false accusations against parents for sexual abuse based on nothing more than supposed memories that were brought out under very dubious conditions involving hypnosis and other things that where suggestibility is a very, very serious problem, and all reasonable psychologists know that. But many people have the idea that it's like a tape recorder and it records things very precisely. And we reconstruct memories and recreate them according to our own beliefs and suggestions. The Predator Panic one was very interesting by Ben Radford, our managing editor in which he's examined the evidence that there are just an epidemic of sexual predators out there about ready to snatch up our children, and finds that it's highly exaggerated and that it doesn't happen nearly as often as is portrayed in the media. And one reason is when there is such a case, it gets total national play, wall-to-wall 24/7 coverage, and it gives the impression that these cases are numerous, when in fact most cases are not anywhere near as abundant as is often portrayed. Mm-hmm.
You know, we're going to have you back to talk about quantum mechanics, because that's one thing I really want to understand.
I may have to get a physicist to help explain quantum mechanics.
Okay, but you know, it's so interesting. You do make a reference to it in the book, where you say, like, quantum mechanics, under which people can say that means anything goes. And you know,
there are a lot of misunderstandings about quantum mechanics, and a lot of claims that it allows weird things to happen, psychic powers and all sorts of things that just aren't true.
Right. One of the things I wanted to tell you is it's very interesting to me, because your favorite part of the book, your favorite chapter in the book is absolutely mine. And in another chapter, The Philosophy Behind Pseudoscience, I thought, he says there that contrary to widespread belief, the scientific method does not exclude speculation, it only disciplines imagination.
Yes, I thought that was a very good line by Professor Mario Bungay, a Canadian philosopher of science.
But I thought at the same time, I thought Androyan's piece, and it's funny, I kept my wife awake the other night because I said, look, I really want you to listen to this, you know. And I would just read it for people, just to get a sense of the poetry that actually runs through this book, and the poetry that runs through Androyan and through a lot of the people that are involved in this whole effort of yours. This is a very, very poetic and soaring book, as well as something where you really learn a lot about science. And I thought it was incredibly important. So let me read something for people to hear, get a little taste of this. And this is from Androyan's Talks About Science, Religion, Wonder, and Awe. And it's in Science Under Siege, Defending Science, Exposing Pseudoscience. She says, what happened 400 or 500 years ago? During this period, there was a great bifurcation. We made a kind of settlement with ourselves. We said, okay, so much of what we believed and what our parents and our ancestors taught us has been rendered untenable. The Bible says the earth is flat. The Bible says that we were created separately from the rest of life. If you look at it honestly, you have to give up these basic ideas. You have to admit that the Bible is not infallible. It's not the gospel truth of the creator of the universe. So what did we do? We made a corrupt treaty that resulted in a troubled peace. We built a wall inside ourselves. It made us sick. In our souls, we cherished a myth that was rootless in nature. What we actually knew of nature, we compartmentalized into a place that could not touch our souls. The churches agreed to stop torturing and murdering scientists. The scientists pretended that knowledge of the universe has no spiritual implications. It's a catastrophic tragedy that science ceded the spiritual uplift of its central revelations, the vastness of the universe, the immensity of time, the relatedness of all life, and its preciousness on this tiny world. When I say spiritual, it's a complicated word that has some unpleasant associations. Still, there has to be a word for that soaring feeling that we experience when we contemplate 13 billion years of cosmic evolution, 4.5 billion years of the story of life on this planet. Why should we give that up? Why do we not give this to our children? Why is it that in a city like Los Angeles, a city of so many churches and temples and mosques, there's only one place like this center for inquiry, and that it's only us here today, fewer than 100 people in a city of millions? Why is that? Why does the message of science not grab people in their souls and give them the kind of emotional gratification that religion has given so many? This is something we have to come to grips with. There's a confusion generally in our society. There's a great wall that separates what we know from what we feel. And I just thought she goes on, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful passage. And I really wanted to thank you for including that in the book, because I thought it just brings so much heart and feeling and real life to this book that's an incredibly important part of defending, like I said, defending science against this terrible, terrible assault, combating ignorance, and enabling people to actually interact with the world and change it. So thank you.
You're so welcome. Thank you for appreciating that particular article in the book so much. Mm-hmm. I can't even follow that. Androyan is a national treasure. She collaborated with Carl Sagan. She's married to him for 20 years and shared his ability to express that poetic sense of wonder and awe about science and understanding the universe that you have just given such a wonderful example of.
All right, Ken, we're going to have to wrap it up right now, but I want to let people know that the book is Science Under Siege, Defending Science, Exposing Pseudoscience, and it's published by Prometheus Books. Well worth the read. Just a tremendous book. Ken, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. I very much appreciate it.
This is Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Kendrick Frazier, the editor of Skeptical Inquirer and the editor of the new anthology Science Under Siege. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Ursula K. Le Guin.
I really want to welcome my next guest. This is an author that I've been a fan of since, too far back for me to reveal. But since I first read Left Hand of Darkness, went on to Dispossessed, and have read many, many other books, it's Ursula K. Le Guin. It's just amazing when you look at the work that she's done. 6 volumes of poetry, 20 novels, over 100 short stories, 4 collections of essays, 11 books for children, 4 volumes of translation. And she has a new novel out now called Voices, which is a tale set in a time and place of extreme oppression, when reading and writing are considered acts punishable by death. Ursula, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you again for the decades of imagination and wonder and awe and thought.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. I generally don't like to pigeonhole things. And I know that in particular, after having read your work as much as I have, I know that you don't like linear connections and sort of straight line cause and effect. But I really have to ask you, just looking at what is going on today in the world, how much of an influence did that have on your writing of Voices?
Well, you know, undoubtedly, a lot, but I don't know how. It's not that I don't like cause and effect and linear connections. I mean, they certainly exist, and I mean, there's science, and I really like science. But a big question like that, where everything is so complicated, why I chose to write this story at this time, I can never tell you. Maybe 20 years later or something I could, you know?
Maybe what I should start off with more is asking you to tell our listeners what this story is about.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, I hate paraphrasing. Well, it's about a kid in a city which was an old commercial, tranquil place that sort of lived off trade and was not warlike, nor was it very threatened. It had become a protectorate of a more warlike state to the south. All of a sudden, it is invaded and taken over by some people sort of out of the desert who are of a completely different culture entirely. For one thing, they're monotheists, and the city people have lots and lots of little gods, and warlike as opposed to peaceful, and so on. And this child is actually a child of a rape during the invasion. She's what's called a siege brat. So she grows up in a conquered city in a kind of half-destroyed culture. Essentially, her people have been enslaved, but she lives in a house where books are kept, and books are now illegal, and with an older relative who can kind of tell her what things were like and give her books to read. So, well, she's all cut out to be a perfect little revolutionary or rebel. She has the information of what things ought to be like, and yet her world is a kind of a destroyed one. So that's the position that you sort of start with.
Yeah, now the reason I was asking, and I agree with you, I think I would go back to that point about linear cause and effect, because I do agree that I also like science a lot, and I think that there is cause and effect in the world, but nothing is ever so simple as one thing directly leads to another, and in terms of without there being many other factors coming into play.
Not in human psychology, anyway.
Right. Or humans.
Maybe in a test tube, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's something that really struck me in this, in terms of the relationship between what we have today and what you've sort of created, and the tale you're telling about what's going on in this world, and the fact that even something as well, for instance, words. One of the things that happens in this conquered society is that the people, the oppressors, the conquerors come in and they view things like literature and words as actual demonic forces.
Written words.
Yeah.
They're an oral culture.
Right.
And so writing is demonic, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And should be destroyed. And those who insist upon reading and writing are destroyed.
And the other part of it that comes in is there's a certain fundamentalism. When you said that they were monotheistic, it's also there's a certain fundamentalism that actually doesn't seem to place much value on or even looks at it as bad, is the idea of critical thinking being essential to human life.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid that monotheism and fundamentalism tend to go hand in hand. Fundamentalism is a monotheistic creation. Now, it has spread and infected even Hinduism by now, but it certainly started with having a book and a word that is right and nothing else, you know, the kind of very cutting the truth down to one single truth.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, when I was reading this and I looked at the idea that you know that the existing literature in this village, in this area, the existing literature was and had to be, you know, spirited away and hidden and protected. The idea that the written word, you couldn't even admit to having read a book or knowing how to read. And I kept thinking of that in relation to the kind of know-nothingism that's generated a lot today, you know, frankly.
Oh, yeah. Well, also, you ask any intellectual American kid who went through a normal American high school if Americans love bookworms. You know what I'm talking about.
Right, yeah.
It can be hell to be 15 years old and be a bookworm. Mm-hmm. Because people, they don't understand, they don't want to understand, and they disapprove. So little mild form of hatred of the book is kind of endemic in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Now you attach, and this is clear in, you know, I think in a lot of what you write, and including in the prequel to this book, To Voices, The Gifts. And, you know, the idea that storytelling and that literature and whether it's oral or written is actually extremely important to humanity or to people, because, you know, it's not just a question of humanity, but it's the cultures that you've created. This kind of thing, this kind of telling of stories is extremely important, and it's extremely important to you. Let's talk about why.
Well, I've come to think, that's a fairly common thought these days, actually, that, in fact, if we're not able to tell stories to each other, if we can't tell each other stories within our society, we're really sick. Things are really falling apart when we lose our stories. Storytelling is, we tend to think of the great author writing the great book and stuff, but actually what we're talking about is a society telling its stories. It's a kind of communal act. And the great writer is a great writer because people read him. They want that book, you know. And it seems to be one way that human communities weave themselves together, a really, really important way, is by telling their story over and over in different ways. This is who we are. And I think it also works for the individual. I think a lot of kids get onto books because they realize that through books they can figure out who I am. You know, the stories are going to tell them to figure out what their story is going to be. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, in particular, I hate coming back to now, but I think there's actually, you know, and this is what I was saying, as much as I was trying to tell you, I don't want to be linear about this, but there's this, you can't help seeing the parallel, I think. Anybody who's at all, you know, has their eyes open at all in the world today, when you see whether it's the fundamentalism here, the Christian fundamentalism here, the Islamic fundamentalism in, you know, in other parts of the world, whatever it is, and including the fact that, you know, the danger of theocracy, the actual encroachment of theocracy in many parts of the world, including right here in this country, and what that means when you have that kind of, you know, that direction to things, and going up against that is actually the idea that people can think, that these stories, that this literature, that people can actually think about what's going on, and that can help shape their ability to analyze and dissect the world.
Right, but what feeds into the fundamentalisms and the theocracies, and this is something that I could not handle in this book, which is a fantasy, of course, is our commercial corporate structure, which allows the stories that Hollywood and TV tells are mostly worthless. They are not useful stories. They do not actually build real community. They aren't very helpful to most of them. The stuff is so stupid and so low level that it's kind of falling down on the job, it seems to me. Our visual media is how we tell a lot of our stories, but so much of it is so just commercially driven that it isn't really telling any story except what it wants to sell. This is something that I couldn't do in the book at all. This is not the kind of thing I'm any good at writing about.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that you are really good at writing about, which is this question, you mentioned writing fantasy in this particular book, but, you know, there's a point that someone made. I was reading some stuff on some, I guess, reviews or some interviews with you earlier that they made the point that you're often miscast as escapist. The fantasy is often miscast as escapist. Yeah. But for you, it's a whole different story. It's not escapist at all. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Cheap, lousy fantasy is escapist, and there's not much harm in it. I mean, everybody needs to escape sometimes. Mm-hmm. But serious fantasy, it's like all other serious literature. It just provides metaphors to talk about the way things actually are. And sometimes to some people, the metaphors of fantasy or science fiction seem kind of far-fetched, and they don't see why a writer needs to use that kind of symbols. But the fact is, we do. It's very hard to discuss things directly. And all our literature is symbolic in one way or another. Mm. And fantasy is just kind of one type. And it seems to be the type that I am particularly good at.
Mm-hmm. And I'm talking today with Ursula K. Le Guin, the author of many, many, many books, essays, poems, all kinds of things, but most recently the author of the novel Voices, the fantasy novel Voices, which has been published by Harcourt, and it's part of a series that's actually going on. The first one was The Gifts, and I think you have a sequel to this you're planning too, right?
I read The Galleys on the third one, which is Powers, mm-hmm. and which has to do, to a large extent, with slavery.
Ah. Well, we're going to explore. We're going to have you back to explore that one too. Because, well, this is exactly where, you know, interesting. This is exactly where I wanted to go on this, because one of the things when I was talking about this not being escapist, one of the things that you really do very, very well is you have taken the exploration of not only how we live, but how we could live. You know, and that's what you've posited in a lot of your work is sort of.
Well, that's kind of the beauty of science fiction and fantasy is they offer alternatives. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, one reason why young people tend to fall for them when they discover them. Because young people are always looking for, you know, life can't really be this way. There's got to be some other way to do it. They just naturally offer alternative ways of being or thinking.
Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about epistemology, too, because...
What is it?
Not yet. We won't get to that. You can throw that in if you want. But I mean, the basic point in relation to voices, you know, you made a statement earlier that it was something, and I'll paraphrase this time, that something along the lines of that, you know, one thing you can count on is that nothing is ever neat. And, you know, that's true in a lot of your work. And it's especially true in voices where so many things are open-ended. So many things are left open to interpretation. So many things come into play. And that when you walk out of there at the end of the novel, that you're left with thinking about what could be choices, what could be, what isn't, what might have been, and not sort of, okay, we have this path set out before us.
Right. Right. Well, that's good. That's good. That's the way I wanted it.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that you also said, though, that, you know, and I think that actually part of what you've done is you've, you know, let's talk about why you wanted that, because it, you know, what do you, why do you attach so much importance to the idea that people should be invited to think? And that's actually what happens with even in the novel itself, in Voices, where the young woman is actually, you know, one of the things I think she finds so frustrating is it seems like she's often looking for clear cut answers, but the things are like a lot more fluid, a lot more liquid, and
yeah.
She has to actually learn to think. Why is that important?
The kid's only 17, and she wants, you know, she wants the revolution, don't we all?
Mm-hmm.
But if they had the revolution, they'd be creamed. She has to realize that. You know, talk about contemporary relevance. Kind of, some people want, they think shock and awe is going to do it, and other people say we could try diplomacy.
Let's throw this around a little bit. As a revolutionary myself, I tended to initially like, okay, let's go with the young woman, let's go with her, and you know, and I kept. Go ahead.
Actually, you know, I had some trouble with I think my editor sort of, she kept waiting for the revolution. And you know, and she realizes that that's what a kid reading the book is going to be waiting for the revolution, and it's not going to happen.
But something does happen there.
It's going to be a big letdown. That's it. What I hope to do is supply something that's actually, it is a revolution, only it's not simple violence.
Yeah, I mean, there's a point about, you know, the resolution of things in the book, as much as there is a resolution, the resolution of things, actually, there's a combination of things that occur. And I think actually the uprising of the people is actually something that, you know, is indispensable to how the thing actually eventually.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. If the citizens didn't turn out in the streets, nothing would ever change. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, let's talk a little bit, let's back on this epistemological approach, because I do want to probe this a little bit more, because
what is epistemology? It's one of those words that I can spell, but I don't know what it means.
We're in big trouble then.
All right, you don't have to define it. Forget.
No. It's how you actually come to know things. How you actually come to know the truth.
Oh, how you come to know.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. How you come to know the truth, okay. That's why I was actually looking at this. This approach that you have about. Nothing is ever neat, and that you invite people to think and to discover and to go through that process and to actually interpret and analyze. And you know, I've been reading a lot, like in particular, Bob Avakian, who's one of the leading Marxist theoreticians in the world today. And he's, you know, he's actually been talking a lot about epistemology and the importance of the clash of ideas in actually uncovering the truth. And I wanted to know how much you view, you know, how you view that. How do you view the importance of the clashing of ideas, the contesting of ideas, in relation to uncovering the truth?
Oh, off the top of my head, it's essential. I mean, that's what you go to college for, is to test received ideas against other received ideas and find out that there is more than one way to think and lose your bearings, you know, and do thesis and antithesis and hope to come out with a synthesis. Yeah, I mean, learning, one whole level of learning just seems to consist of questioning the received idea.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I was going to say too is that, you know, I know you've said before too that you're sometimes you're often tempted to, and I think you were, you know, just generally in terms of your view of things, that you're tempted to, I don't know, you know, there's always a attempt to moralize. There's always a temptation to moralize. There's always a attempt to try and preach
a
lesson.
Get up on the soapbox, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you also, you know, this point about there's that temptation, but then you have actually, you know, you've made a comment about that won't work for you or for discovering the truth. And yet at the same time, even in this book, like you were saying, there's sort of a balance that you've tried to approach. But the one thing I like about your work is that you always have that balance, but there's always something that undermines it. And the point is, I think, in the final analysis, balance isn't the answer. You're actually, you would never allow balance to supersede truth. And you do speak it to things from the viewpoint of the underdog, of the oppressed in most of your books.
Yeah, I do. Comes of partly being a woman. But, you know, balance to a lot of people means stasis, that you arrive at a balance and then you stay there. To me, balance is what you do when you walk. You balance on your left foot and then you balance on your right, and that's how you keep going. You've got to be in balance in order to walk, but the whole thing is a balancing act. Any kind of forward progress or backwards requires being in balance. And to me, what real stasis, what real really being stuck, is when things are so out of balance that they fall down and don't move, sort of, which mm-hmm. is kind of where the city is at when this book opens.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were talking about writing from the point of view of the oppressed and saying that, you know, and I think that actually has been, from the very beginning, you've actually been one of the people who pioneered the bringing into science fiction, into fantasy, people who don't normally populate the you know, science fiction and fantasy.
They didn't used to. Mm-hmm. There are more of them these days. I mean, the kind of the under people.
Right. You're listening to Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Ursula K. Le Guin. We're going to take a quick break and be right back. Thank you. For people who are just tuning in now, I'm speaking with Ursula K. Le Guin about her new book, Voices, and her work in general and some of the thinking behind that and what's going on in the world today and what's going on in the world that Ursula creates and many of the worlds that Ursula creates, because she's one of the few people in the universe that's actually created about 20 worlds. Well, let's talk about that. You said that they used to, you know, this bringing of people who aren't, you know, who weren't part of the population of the particular genre that you work in.
Well, they used to be kind of the heroes, the guys with the spaceships, and the masses, who, you know, kind of like in Godzilla or something, that most people run screaming mm-hmm. in old-fashioned science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually incredibly elitist and incredibly male-centered. There weren't any women that counted for anything, and I'm talking way back now. That's when I kind of came crawling into the field from left wing back in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
50s.
Mm-hmm.
And that there is still a lot of science fiction that is kind of written that way, that the, you know, the computer geek is going to save the world and all the rest of us poor nerds. But the nerds there are more nerds in science fiction and fantasy than there used to be. In fantasy, they're not all kings and princesses anymore. There are actual peasants.
Mm-hmm. One of the beautiful things about your work is you actually manage to make the most profound points by the portrayal of people in no matter what world they're in who are basic, struggling to get through the world people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
trying to keep alive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they are in fact the ones who you know bring on the most fundamental and profound changes. Which I find really, really, really important.
Mm.
And speaking of which, now, in terms of changes, again, you've also, this point about bringing women in, which was a big, big point. I remember one of the things, I remember just trying to get my head wrapped around the gender bending that you did in Left Hand of Darkness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was just incredible. you want to talk about provoking critical thought and a whole new way of looking at the world? I mean, you know, and I'll paraphrase because you don't like to paraphrase, but the idea that you had these beings who, in terms of their interpersonal relations, that at varying times, either one could be what would be the equivalent of the female partner or the male partner. They could change, and either one could get pregnant based on various changes. And it's just the whole idea of gender took on – you didn't have gender, basically.
Right. I deconstructed gender, as they would say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was fun.
I would have loved to have been in the house with you at that time. Let's get your husband on the phone.
I have a bunch of little kids running around.
There you go. You know, the other thing that you've brought in, the other thing that you brought into science fiction and fantasy is oppressed nationalities, ethnicity, race. You know, and that was a big. Anybody who reads your work notices that there's. It's not that there are no white people, but they certainly don't occupy the position that they occupy in mainstream.
They tend to be marginal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of my few really conscious political decisions, particularly both in fantasy and in science fiction, was simply to put people of color at the center. And like in A Wizard of Earthsea, which is my first major fantasy, you don't find out that the hero with whom hopefully you have identified by now is kind of a copper brown guy until way into the book. I was hoping literally to trap American white adolescents into getting into a different skin.
Hmm.
And then, you know, being comfortable there and then finding out, oh, hey, he's not a white man, you know.
Uh-huh.
Some of the most moving letters I've had, they've all been fairly recent. They're from adolescents of color, both in England and in America, who said they could never read any fantasy or science fiction until they found my stuff because they weren't in it.
Hmm.
And they were in my books. And I thought, all right, it paid off. That's all I was after, you
mm-hmm.
know,
mm-hmm.
was to include people who had been just completely thoughtlessly without any agenda, but excluded. Totally. Fantasy was a completely white field except for one great book, which is Kipling's Jungle Books.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the only brown hero of a major fantasy that I can think of before, I don't know, the 60s, 70s.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me, you know, and I keep thinking, God, there's so many things we could pursue in here. I mean, you've written things that, analogies to, you know, the Vietnam War. You've written things about the rebuilding of a society in the, you know, post-apocalyptic societies that actually you've described as your most hopeful book. Isn't that correct? The Always Coming Home?
Yeah, except it's so long after whatever it is that happened, mm-hmm. which I think is probably more an ecological disaster than mm-hmm. just a mm-hmm. Holocaust. I mean, well, it's the other Holocaust. It's the big one we're building mm-hmm. now, not the atomic one. Yeah, but it's so long after that, you know, it's not kind of Love Amid the Ruins.
Right, right.
The ruins are so old, they've forgotten what they're from.
Hmm. Well, you know, the reason I was getting into this is because I have two more questions for you. And one is, I want to step back again into this point about critical thinking, because, you know, when you think about this and what you've created in, and even, you know, in the gifts where, you know, everything you're led to expect is turned on its head at the end. And you have to actually think, you know, you start to think about, well, wait a minute, there's something that's being posited here that's a minor point until the end of the book. And then you realize that this actually could be the way things were and how they changed and how they developed. But you have to be, you know, you seem to be taking, you know, really pushing people into this point where they can't just accept what's going on. And something I read, a statement that you made, and it may have been in a speech that you recently gave. I guess you were given an award in Washington mm-hmm. around literature. And where you talked about the relationship between literature and government. And I felt that in that, there's actually a relationship between critical thinking and literature and critical thinking and government. And today, boy or so, I tell you, you can't get away from this. You know, the idea that critical thought, or the idea that the kind of books that you write that you've written for adolescents in Voices and the Gift, and it's not just for adolescents. I really want to make it clear. Like I said, as I was telling you earlier, I just stayed up and reread the book, and I loved it. You know, and I think it's anybody who has any idea of, you know, what's happening in the world today and is looking for some sort of way of digging into this and imagining a way out of it. This book is extremely important. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about how you see that fitting into this whole war on critical thinking that's going on, the war on science even, but the war on critical thought in particular.
Wow. Yeah, the kind of know-nothing mm-hmm. thing, or we sort of, we've been told the truth, so we're going to cling to it and shut our eyes and mm-hmm. not peek in case there happens to be another inconvenient truth around the corner. Of course, that's exactly what we've done with the ecological disaster. Mm-hmm. Is just not look. It's more basic than not doing critical thinking. It's just not looking. It's refusing to see what has. I mean, my Lord, we've been told what was going to happen for 30 years. What we're doing with our dependence on oil, for instance, and so on. And we, not only will we not think critically, we have refused to think at all. We just sort of go blindly ahead. One is driven to either despair or well, you know, better late than never.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things I was thinking about too is that you know, and I'd ask you this again too, is that, you know, there's this theocracy that you've got posed in Voices, and, you know, and there's other places where the whole idea of, you know, like as you said, monotheism and fundamentalism and this theocratic rule in society, this is definitely something that I think more and more people in this country have been coming to see as actually a big possibility in terms of the foundational attack, the attacks on things that are foundational, the separation of church and state being, you know, yeah. demolished, all this. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, one thought is right away, let's give Margaret Atwood a little credit there.
Absolutely.
And that Handmaid's Daughter. Remember how she had a just really quick, easy takeover mm-hmm. of the United States by a theocratic government.
Mm-hmm.
One thing they did was simply stop all the credit to women's credit cards. A couple of neat little tricks like that.
Mm-hmm.
She was thinking along those lines, too. And she realized way back, that book's, 20 years old now,
mm-hmm.
How easy, you know, this could happen if the people aren't looking. Or if they're clinging to their comfort and ignoring anything that makes them uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of doom scenarios in science fiction, goodness knows. I'm not the only one that has tried to show how easy it might be to slide into a fascism or a theocracy or any way out of democracy, which is, you know, like Jefferson said, it takes constant maintenance, eternal vigilance.
You know, one of the things that, and this is moving on here, but, to the final part of this, one of the things in terms of, I don't, you know, when you talked about, just presenting these doomed societies, to me, actually, as I told you when I first wrote to you, The Dispossessed was and remains one of my most favorite novels ever. And I, you know, because not only did you, you showed worlds that were in contradiction, you showed a world, that had its flaws, but still, basically, a world that was built on a whole different way of humans relating to each other, of people relating to each other, of beings relating to each other, in a world that could be built that wasn't based on commodity production and exchange, it wasn't based on profit and command, but was based on the consensus of the people interacting with nature and trying to figure out how are we going to get somewhere off of this.
Right.
So, now I have two questions for you. You've created a lot of worlds, as I said. You know, you've created a tremendous number of worlds. And, you know, the first question I'd have for you is in relation to The Dispossessed. You actually, when I mentioned that stuff to you about The Dispossessed, when I was first writing to you, you wrote back and you said you thought you could not write that book today, but you were so glad that you could write it then. Why would you say that?
To write The Dispossessed took like 3 years of real reading everything any silly anarchist had ever written and a lot of what the Marxists wrote and trying to pull it together, reading a lot of utopias, and also reading a lot about the nature of time because my hero was a temporal physicist.
Mm-hmm.
I was holding more stuff in my head than I can now believe I ever had in my head. I had more energy in those days, let's put it that way. I just literally couldn't do anything that complicated.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you look around at the, you know, what you were just describing, I mean, to me, it's just sort of, you know, this whole idea of exploring all these facets of this world. This brings me to my final question, which is, in all these worlds that you created, I was going to ask you something that I'm robbing from another interviewer that talked with you. Something that actually said, that you were asked, have you ever found a world that you liked? And I was going to ask you that. And then I thought, well, in a way, I would be disappointed if you had, but not just because of traveling around and thought experiments and whatnot, but also just going around and looking at, you know, the idea that the process never ends, you know, and it goes back to this epistemological question we were talking about before, mm-hmm. the process never ends. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about that.
Okay, now, have I ever found a world that I liked?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I like most of the worlds that I discover. If I didn't like them in one way or another, if I didn't find them at least very interesting, I wouldn't want to live in them for the year or two it takes to write a novel.
Mm-hmm.
The one I like best is the world of Always Coming Home, which is the Napa Valley. Very obviously is the Napa Valley, a very long time from now in the future, but still, every single plant and animal there is exactly, and even the topography, if you look at the maps. I love the Napa Valley, so I overlaid my world on her world mm-hmm. in that one, and that was particularly fun, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
Writing that book was a great joy, but it gave me both a nostalgic trip back to my old Napa Valley of the 30s and 40s, which is a pretty different place from what's mm-hmm. there now.
Mm-hmm.
And also the chance to sort of look at it, you know, as you say, rethink it, figure out how could we treat this beautiful piece of the world rightly? How could we live properly, rightly on this land so that we were actually worthy of it instead of just exploiting it? Does that answer your question at all?
Yeah, it does. It does. But I'd also just that, you know, to finish up this point that you've made, you once said that to close the thought process, to clinch a thought, that's really not what you view as an option, to actually just close it down, because it cuts off the realm of possibility.
Oh, no, leave the door open. Mm-hmm. If possible, leave all the doors and windows open
mm-hmm.
when you leave the house. That's my policy. Don't you wish we could?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's the point, though, is that, you know, the endless possibility there, not just for imagination, but for actually people creating a new world. And that's where we have to get. And I think we have to go through some horrible mess to get there.
You know it, but I agree with you. That's where we have to get. And we do have the capacity to do it, I do think.
Mm-hmm. All right, Ursula, thank you very much for joining me now. And I'll have to have you back to talk about the third book, which is Powers.
Yeah.
Okay, and I want to remind people that I've been talking with Ursula Le Guin, the author of Voices and the prequel to that, which is called The Gifts, and they're put out by Harcourt. And it's really an amazing book. You know, if you're looking for something to get a younger person you know, or you just want to get it for yourself, you just can't get enough. I can't get enough of it. Ursula, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye now. That's our show for today. I want to thank Kendrick Fraser and Ursula K. Le Guin. I want to thank all of you for tuning in. And don't forget, next week you'll be tuning into Red Future Radio with Michael Slate. I'm the host and producer of this show, Michael Slate. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out with a very appropriate piece from the OJs. Give the people what they want.